I got into the car with a drunk driver. I don't really remember much, but I do remember waking up with the car on its side and just hurting. I ended up talking to my mom and she told me to call the advocates. Even though it was complicated and I felt guilty, there was zero judgment from them. I felt like they were always on my side and they were always doing what was best for me.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. If guilt is keeping you from getting help, just call us. We'll represent you and remind you that you deserve justice.
So I was on my motorcycle, heading home, is going through this intersection, and this car just turns left in front of me. They said they didn't see me, obviously, and I hit them broadside, flew over the car, and landed, broke my arm, busted my shoulder. It wasn't good. Luckily, I had my helmet on, but yeah, I was mad. So a buddy told me to call the advocates. But, you know, I've always been skeptical of lawyers, right? But I called them. They were cool. They listened to me, and they were on my side for sure. They took care of everything. They're a good group of people. They helped me get what I deserved. They worked with the insurance companies. They got everything paid for. They fight for you, and they're going to go for the win.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. I totally get that bikers are independent, but when someone else causes a crash, you need a team as tough as you. Give us a call.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are setting aside the theoretical and really strapping ourselves into the world of practical, high-stakes precision. Mm-hmm. We're going deep into the essential equipment, the rigorous maintenance, and the, well, the grueling, but absolutely non-negotiable science of calibration.
And this deep dive is, you know, it's hyper-focused. We've specifically curated this resource to act as a crucial study guide for you, the learner.
Right.
Especially if you're aiming to pass Category B of the QAL exam in California.
That's the Qualified Applicator License Exam.
Exactly. And it focuses so heavily on this application technology. The material we're covering isn't just theory. I mean, it's the difference between legal compliance and potentially severe liability.
And we should pause right there to acknowledge the source for all this.
Yeah.
This comprehensive stack of material was generated by Within Range Coaching.
That's right.
Their fundamental mission is to build a broader and better agriculture. Mm. And getting these technical details right, the complex math, the maintenance schedules, it's just central to that mission.
It really is. It emphasizes safety, compliance, and crucially, efficacy. Mm-hmm. Our mission today is to distill this massive body of knowledge. I mean, we're covering everything from the mechanics of a simple handheld sprayer all the way up to complex hydraulic systems and the intricate flow rate formulas that govern them.
So we're essentially giving you the shortcut to precision.
That's the goal.
So let's start with the ultimate why. Why should a professional applicator who's already juggling licenses, PPE, and changing weather care so much about calibration that they need to memorize formulas? What are the actual stakes?
Well, the stakes are fourfold, and they are incredibly high. Calibration is the linchpin of pest management. First, there's the risk of failure and waste.
Okay.
If you use less product than the label specifies, you waste time, you waste money, and you risk a treatment failure. That can lead to pest resurgence or, even worse, contribute to pesticide resistance.
And on the flip side, I imagine using too much product brings the hammer down.
It does. That's number two. Legal compliance and financial liability. Exceeding the label rate is wasteful and it's illegal. Handlers and employers are legally liable for damages from improper application. We're talking heavy fines, penalties.
Wow.
And third is environmental and surface protection. Over-application leads directly to illegal hazardous residues on plants, a condition we call phytotoxicity.
Phytotoxicity, that's like a chemical burn, right?
It's exactly that, a chemical burn on the plant. It also risks contaminating water, the air, and endangering beneficial insects and wildlife.
So calibration isn't just about math. It's about being an environmental steward and a compliant business operator all at once. It sounds like the highest stakes procedure on the job.
Absolutely. It ensures the right amount of active ingredient hits the right target at the right time.
Okay, let's unpack this. We'll start with the gear itself, the physical anatomy of a liquid sprayer. Whether you're looking at a huge tractor-mounted boom or just a small handheld unit, they all share a core structure, don't they?
That's right. Every liquid application device, no matter how complex, is built on the same core components. It all starts with the tank or container to hold the diluted mixture.
Of course.
Then you need the hoses or pipes to transfer that solution. You have to have a pump or some device to generate the pressure. And then, most importantly, you have the nozzles.
The business end.
That's the business end. They break the liquid stream into controlled droplets and direct them to the target.
And on the larger, more advanced systems, we start seeing all the critical accessories pop up.
Correct. You'll see pressure regulators to ensure consistent spray pressure. Filter screens are essential to prevent clogs, especially with, you know, slightly dirty water or certain formulations.
Right.
You'll also need control valves and agitators, which are really, really important for formulations like wettable powders that tend to settle out.
Ah, so it keeps the mixture consistent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And finally, on powered equipment, you see the booms that hold multiple nozzles for that wide coverage.
Okay, let's start with the most common tools then. The low-tech end of the spectrum. Hand-operated devices.
These are the workhorses of detail work and confined spaces. They're inexpensive, lightweight, and they typically operate at low pressure.
Simple.
Very simple. Because they have few moving parts, they're easy to repair, making them great for small or hard-to-reach applications. Think flower beds, interior scapes, a single shrub.
Now, since most of these small tanks lack a mechanical agitator like you just mentioned, what's the operational responsibility for the applicator?
They need to understand that the consistency of the product depends entirely on them. If they're using a formulation that settles, like a wettable powder, they have to physically shake that sprayer occasionally to keep the mixture uniform.
And if they don't?
If they stop shaking for too long, the concentration of the active ingredient being sprayed will just plummet as the tank nears empty, and that leads to underapplication.
Okay, so let's talk about the highest stakes safety warning with these simple devices. This is a compliance point that absolutely cannot be missed.
Mm-hmm.
The danger of residue.
This is a critical legal and financial liability point. You should never use a sprayer that has previously been used for herbicides to then apply insecticides or fungicides to desirable plants, or vice versa.
Never. Not even if you clean it really well.
No. Even meticulous cleaning often leaves trace amounts of residue in the tank lining, in the seals, in the hoses.
And what does that tiny trace amount of herbicide residue do when you're spraying an ornamental shrub with an insecticide a week later?
It creates that phytotoxicity we mentioned. Mm. That tiny residue can cause severe chemical damage, leaf curling, bleaching, or even death to the treated plant.
And that means costly replacements and fines.
Exactly. The recommendation is absolute. Dedicate your sprayers. Use one specifically for herbicides and another set for insecticides and fungicides. It's just an investment in risk mitigation.
Let's move through the list of specific types, starting with the simplest of all, the aerosol cans.
These are the definition of ready-to-use, or RTU. They use an inert compressed gas as a propellant. They're incredibly convenient for targeted applications, you know, cracks, crevices, treating a single pest on a houseplant.
But there's a trade-off.
A clear one. They have the highest cost per unit of active ingredient compared to any concentrate, by far.
Next up, hose-end sprayers, which are really common for residential lawns and shrubs.
Yeah, these are ingenious because they rely on the water pressure from your garden hose. The concentrate is held in a small reservoir, and the water flow creates a vacuum that pulls the concentrate into the water stream, producing a huge volume of diluted spray.
And what's the single most important safety feature that has to be present on a hose-end sprayer system?
The anti-siphon valve. This is non-negotiable. It has to be installed on the hose or the faucet. Its only purpose is to prevent the backflow of the pesticide mixture into the municipal water supply if the pressure drops.
A critical public health protection measure.
Absolutely.
Moving on to the pump action items, trigger pump sprayers.
These are your basic spray bottles, you know, pint to 1 gallon capacity. Simple, low pressure, used for diluted mixtures in very small areas. They're best for truly soluble liquids, since they don't really have the capacity to handle suspensions.
Okay, stepping up in tank size and pressure, we find the compressed air or pump sprayers.
These use airtight tanks up to about 5 gallons. Pressure is generated either by manual hand pumping or, and this is the superior option for consistency, by using compressed carbon dioxide CO2 cartridges.
If an applicator wants to save money, why shouldn't they just rely on hand pumping? What's the real difference in the field?
Hand pumping results in wildly variable pressure.
I can imagine.
Yeah, as the operator gets tired or they pause to move, the pressure drops. And that inconsistency translates directly into a non-uniform application rate. The spray pattern changes. The amount of product hitting the target fluctuates.
Where is the CO2?
The CO2 cartridges maintain a precise, even pressure from the first drop to the last. That ensures the most uniform application rate possible for that style of sprayer. That consistency is worth the extra cost.
And the standard backpack sprayers.
The standard models hold 3 to 5 gallons and use a hand-operated hydraulic pump. They can generate over 100 PSI, which is great for penetrating moderately dense foliage.
But it's work.
It's work. It requires continuous movement of the lever to maintain that pressure, demanding a constant effort from the applicator.
Okay, finally, let's talk about a highly specialized tool designed to deal with that drift problem we've been emphasizing. The rope wick, or pad applicator.
This is just a mechanical marvel of simplicity, used almost exclusively for applying systemic herbicides. The mechanism is a cloth pad or a rope wick that's saturated with a water-soluble herbicide mixture.
And you just wipe it on.
You physically wipe that saturated surface directly onto the leaves of the target weed.
The primary advantage is huge, then. It completely eliminates drift. But what's the technical limitation?
Because it relies on absorption through contact, it only...
I got into the car with a drunk driver. I don't really remember much, but I do remember waking up with the car on its side and just hurting. I ended up talking to my mom and she told me to call the advocates. Even though it was complicated and I felt guilty, there was zero judgment from them. I felt like they were always on my side and they were always doing what was best for me.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. If guilt is keeping you from getting help, just call us. We'll represent you and remind you that you deserve justice.
It works with systemic, water-soluble herbicides. It's fantastic for treating taller weeds growing inside a desirable turf grass area where spraying would just be impossible without causing damage.
Okay, so that covers the hand-operated gear. Let's scale up.
Right. Once you move beyond small properties and into large turf areas, sports fields, or expansive landscapes, powered equipment becomes mandatory. This is where maintenance gets more complex, but the gains in efficiency are massive.
And the entry point to this power category is the powered backpack sprayer.
Correct. These use a small gasoline engine to drive the pump, offering much greater consistency than the hand-operated versions. They're best for low-volume applications. The small tank size is still a limitation, though.
Next, the low-pressure sprayers, or LPS.
These are your towed units, often pulled by an ATV or a tractor, operating at a pressure range of about 20 to 40 PSI. They have large tanks, 30 to over 100 gallons, and they feature multiple nozzles on a boom for wide swaths of coverage.
And they can be adapted for other uses.
Yeah, a neat feature is their versatility. They can often be easily adapted for specialized applications like deep soil injection.
Then we hit the heavy hitters, high-pressure hydraulic sprayers, or HPHS.
These operate at 100 PSI and much, much higher. They're mounted on trailers or trucks, powered by a substantial engine. They're used for high-volume applications on large turf areas or for specialized treatments on large trees where penetration is critical.
That high pressure sounds like it solves the penetration problem, but it definitely creates a massive risk management headache.
It does. The high pressure needed for thorough coverage drastically increases the risk of generating very fine droplets.
And those fine droplets lead directly to drift.
Directly to drift. That said, most professional HPHS units can be regulated down with pressure controls to function safely as an LPS when you need it, which offers necessary flexibility.
The applicator needs a way to direct all that power. That's where the hand spray gun comes in, right?
The spray gun is an essential accessory for an HPHS. It has adjustable valves, interchangeable nozzles, and it allows the operator to switch instantly between a long, high-pressure stream for reaching the top of a tall tree and a softer, fan-shaped spray for dense shrubs.
Okay, let's talk physics for a second. We mentioned this earlier, the electrostatic sprayer. This is where we shift from brute mechanical force to using the science of attraction.
Exactly. This system applies the pesticide as small, negatively charged droplets, averaging around 50 microns in size. And the crucial insight is that most plant surfaces naturally carry a slight positive charge.
So the plant itself acts as a magnet for the spray.
It does. The negatively charged droplets are actively drawn to that positively charged plant surface. And the genius of the system is twofold. First, the negative charges on the droplets repel each other, which prevents clumping and ensures extremely uniform coverage.
Ah, so they spread out evenly.
They do. Hmm. And second, this mutual repulsion means the droplets naturally spread out and often wrap around the target foliage, providing excellent coverage on the undersides of leaves where pests love to hide.
That is incredible coverage efficiency. But what's the operational constraint? Why aren't these used everywhere?
The electrostatic effect diminishes rapidly with distance. As the space between the sprayer and the target increases, the attraction just gets weaker. So its effectiveness is limited, typically best for controlled environments, smaller fields, or greenhouses, not massive open field applications.
Okay, moving from the whole machine to its single most critical component, the nozzle. You said this tiny part dictates the success or failure of the whole application.
That is not hyperbole. Nozzles are the most important part of the sprayer. They control four vital parameters: the application rate, the droplet size, which governs drift, the spray pattern, and ultimately the thoroughness and safety of the coverage.
So if the nozzle is that critical, let's talk about its enemy: wear and tear. What destroys a nozzle fastest?
Well, wear is a product of design, formulation, and pressure. But the biggest factor is the formulation.
What do you mean?
Suspended solids, like wettable powders, WPs, act like sandpaper. They cause high abrasion and very rapid wear. True solutions cause the least wear. And of course, high pressure accelerates everything.
So if I'm using an expensive wettable powder, I should basically expect to replace my brass nozzles every few applications.
Precisely. And from a calibration standpoint, this is lethal. Wear changes the size of the orifice, which means it changes the spray volume and it distorts the pattern. A worn nozzle delivers more liquid than it should.
What's the golden rule for replacing nozzles, especially on a boom sprayer?
The standard for uniformity is that you must replace nozzles when the output varies by more than 10% between any two identical nozzles on the boom.
10%.
And any single nozzle that exceeds the manufacturer's rated output by more than 10% must be replaced immediately.
What does that 10% variation actually translate to in the field? Let's say I'm spraying a lawn.
It means that if your target rate is 1.5 pounds per acre, one section of your boom is blasting out 1.65 pounds per acre. You're potentially causing phytotoxicity or just wasting 10% of your expensive product. You have to maintain uniform performance.
So that brings us to the strategic choice of materials. This is where long-term cost savings meets calibration precision.
We can categorize them by longevity versus cost. Brass is inexpensive, but it wears out quickly. If you use it with anything abrasive, you will be replacing and recalibrating constantly.
So the initial savings are lost over time?
Easily. The cost adds up to more than the price of a durable nozzle.
So what's the investment grade material then?
On the high end, you have stainless steel, which offers good resistance to both corrosion and abrasion. Even better are the inserts made of tungsten carbide and ceramic.
Oh, okay.
These are the gold standard for high pressure or highly abrasive sprays. They last significantly longer, maintaining calibration accuracy over hundreds of hours of use.
And the plastic option?
Plastic is the least expensive and resists corrosion well. However, it has very low resistance to abrasion. And here's the critical warning for compliance. Solid plastic nozzles can swell and distort if they're exposed to organic solvents.
So you can't use them with certain formulations?
Right. You should only use solid plastic nozzles with water-soluble pesticides, never with certain emulsifiable concentrates unless the manufacturer explicitly says it's okay.
Okay, so now for patterns. Different jobs require different sprays. Let's start with the conventional standard, the flat spray nozzle.
The conventional flat spray nozzle produces a fan-shaped pattern that tapers off toward the ends. Because of this tapering, the spray density is highest in the center. To ensure uniform coverage on a boom, you have to achieve a specific overlap.
And that required overlap is 30%, correct?
Yes. You must space the nozzles and adjust the boom height to ensure 30% overlap of adjacent spray patterns. This is absolutely non-negotiable for an even application.
And there's another trick to it, isn't there?
There is. To prevent the droplets from colliding with each other, which would make them fall out of the spray. Cloud manufacturers also recommend rotating the nozzles 10 degrees from the axis of the boom.
If the conventional flat spray requires overlap, then the even flat spray does not.
Precisely. The even flat spray provides a uniform distribution right across the entire width of the fan, with no tapering at the ends. So they are used specifically for applications where overlap is not desired, like band applications or when you're using a single spray wand.
You mentioned the drift problem earlier. Which flat spray nozzle is engineered specifically to fight that?
That's the low-pressure flat spray nozzle. It can operate effectively at pressures as low as 10 psi. Operating at low pressure produces significantly larger, heavier droplets, which are much less susceptible to wind drift.
A crucial tool for windy days.
Or near any sensitive environmental boundaries, yes.
What about when you need to penetrate thick, dense foliage, say, to treat a fungal issue deep inside a hedge?
For deep penetration, especially for insecticides and fungicides on dense foliage, you need cone nozzles. They create either a hollow or a solid cone pattern, and the finer droplets they produce ensure better coverage and reach deep into the plant canopy.
Before we move on, let's decipher the language of nozzles. You often see a code stamped on the tip, like 8004. How do we read that?
It's the nozzle's fingerprint, and understanding it is key. The first two digits, 80, represent the fan angle in degrees, so an 80-degree fan. The last two digits, 04, indicate the rated volume output, 0.4 gallons per minute, or GPM.
And that's at a standard pressure?
Always. It's calculated at the standard rated operating pressure, which is typically 40 psi. If you change the pressure, the flow rate changes, but that code anchors you to the manufacturer's performance baseline.
Okay, liquid application is one thing, but granule application dry particles has its own set of precision challenges.
It does. When you're using granular formulations, precision is highly dependent.
My family and I were on an outing. We stopped at a stoplight on a highway, and all of a sudden I see in my rearview mirror that there is a truck coming straight for us, rammed right into the back of us. It ended up being a four-car pileup. Luckily, we had a luggage rack on the back that took most of the blow, but we still sustained some injuries that needed significant medical care. I felt confident, feeling I can handle all the calls. I know the story. I know how to talk to the insurance agents and file the reports, and I know how to negotiate. I totally thought that I had this. It added up to be too much, and I just wish that I had called the advocates way sooner. I finally called the advocates, and they took it from there. They know the drill. They know how to do this. They ended up getting a settlement for me that was twice the amount that I thought that I could get on my own.
I'm Matt with the Advocates Injury Lawyers. When your family's hurting, you shouldn't have to fight the insurance companies. Let the advocates carry that burden for you. Give us a call.
On the particle shape and size. If the formulation is sold as pellets, where all the particles are identical, calibration becomes significantly easier.
Let's start with the low-tech option.
Yeah.
The hand-operated applicators, the belly grinders.
Right. These strap to the operator's chest. Granules drop through an adjustable opening onto a hand-cranked spinning plate. While they're useful and inexpensive for very small areas, they're difficult to use accurately.
It's all on the operator.
The quality of application hinges entirely on the operator's consistency, steady cranking, and a steady walking speed. If they speed up or slow down, the rate changes dramatically.
Moving up in precision, we have drop spreaders.
Drop spreaders are the choice for precision. They have an agitator bar rotating over adjustable openings, ensuring the granules fall straight down within the machine's wheelbase.
What are the pros and cons of that straight-down method?
The pros are greater precision and a clean pattern with minimal drift. The cons are that they require a slight overlap to guarantee uniformity, and they are highly susceptible to clogging if the granules or the turf are moist.
And the most critical operator practice to prevent misapplication.
You must always turn off the spreader when turning corners or stopping.
Always.
If the spreader is dispensing product while stationary or turning, you create areas of massive overapplication. A good technique is to treat the perimeter first, which gives you a clear, already treated zone for turning.
The other major type is the rotary granule applicator, which prioritizes speed and swath width.
These use a spinning disc driven by the ground wheels to scatter granules over a wide area, often 6 to 8 feet wide. The rate of application is a function of both the port opening size and the travel speed.
So speed is paramount here too, but the pattern is less precise than a drop spreader.
Generally, yes. Especially if the granules are irregular in size or weight, which causes non-uniform scattering. Because the material is thrown so wide, there are two crucial operational practices. First, you have to run a border swath around the edge of the area first to prevent throwing material onto sidewalks or other non-target surfaces.
And if you accidentally hit a sidewalk?
You must sweep those granules off non-target surfaces immediately and back onto the treatment area. Second, unlike the drop spreader, with a rotary spreader, you have to close the ports before you stop walking.
Why is that?
If you stop walking while the port is still open, the ground wheel driven spinning plate slows and stops, causing a huge concentration of granules to drop right at that spot.
Okay, we've established that drift is a major liability. So now let's move into the highly targeted methods designed to mitigate that risk, which must be essential for applicators in populated areas.
This section represents the surgical approach. Getting the product exactly where it needs to be into the soil, the wood, or the pest itself without broadcasting it into the air.
Let's start with soil drenches and soil injection. These use systemic pesticides, right?
They do. So the plant absorbs them through the roots. And the safety payoff is huge. A massive reduction in drift and public exposure risk. For applicators working near busy streets or in parks, this is often the most practical and legally defensible option.
What's the technique?
It requires relatively low pressure, typically under 25 psi, to ensure the chemical enters the soil without just running off. The equipment can be a sophisticated powered tank sprayer with an injector probe or simple handheld equipment for just a few plants.
Okay, let's get even more surgical with tree injection and implantation.
When you're treating highly valuable or stressed crees, you go straight to the xylem. The purpose is to apply systemic products directly into the vascular system.
And the primary advantage, again, is maximum safety. How do the three techniques, macroinjection, microinjection, and implantation, differ?
Macroinjection is the most aggressive. It forces a liquid pesticide mixture, via tubing, into holes bored into the trunk. It's time-consuming, requires several hours, and constant monitoring.
Microinjection is less invasive, I take it.
Yes. It uses small, pressurized plastic capsules inserted into smaller, shallower, pre-drilled holes. This technique relies on the tree's natural transpiration, the negative pressure created by water evaporating from the leaves, to pull the pesticide upward.
So, if I have a dormant tree in winter, microinjection is useless.
That's the key limitation. Without transpiration, there is no flow in the xylem to move the pesticide, so microinjection is completely ineffective on dormant trees.
And the third type, implantation.
Implantation involves inserting solid, water-soluble chemical capsules into the outer sapwood. The capsule dissolves slowly over time, offering a long-term release and extended control.
We've established the huge benefit here, but what is the major structural disadvantage that applicators have to weigh before choosing this method?
This is the strategic tension we have to address. Every injection or implantation creates a visible wound in the tree trunk. And these wounds, no matter how cleanly they're made, can serve as potential entry paths for subsequent pathogens, decay fungi, and wood-boring insects.
So you could solve one problem and create another.
You absolutely could. It's an expensive and time-consuming treatment, and the risk of that collateral damage has to be justified by the pest threat.
Shifting gears to pest control via ingestion or capture bait and trapping. Bait stations are common for rodents and ants.
And when you're using poison food, the critical legal and safety requirement is the use of tamper-resistant bait stations. These prevent access by children, pets, and non-target wildlife.
And failure to use them is a massive violation.
A massive violation, especially in publicly accessible areas.
Let's talk about the non-toxic option, trapping. We often think of this as the safest method.
Trapping is often safer and, for many pests, produces quicker, verifiable results than poisons. But to maximize efficacy, you have to be tactical.
For the common snap trap, what are the best practices for placement?
First, use a high volume of traps. Place them along the pest's established runways. To prevent rodents from jumping over the mechanism, place two traps end to end, flush against a wall.
And there's a trick to lubricating them, isn't there?
A critical niche detail. Petroleum oil repels rodents. If you need to lubricate the trap mechanism to prevent rust, use lard or animal fat, not petroleum oil.
And what about conditioning the pest to overcome trap shyness?
You should bait the traps, but leave them unset for several days until the rodents are comfortable eating the bait. Once they reliably take it, then you set the spring.
Okay, we've talked about all the gear. Now we transition to the procedure that makes the gear effective. Maintenance and calibration. Without these steps, the application risks fall apart.
This is the section that defines the professional. Calibration is your ultimate professional mandate.
What's the baseline schedule for a professional applicator's maintenance?
Inspection for wear, corrosion, or damage must be conducted before each and every use. Thorough cleaning is required after every single application. And while cleaning or repairing, you must always wear the required PPC gloves and eye protection.
Okay, let's restate the core mission of calibration clearly.
The core reason is to precisely determine the correct amount of pesticide to add to the tank or hopper to ensure that the label-specified application rate is met across the target area.
And let's elaborate on the consequences of getting it wrong.
If you apply too little, you're guaranteeing a failed control program. You waste product, time, and money. It also accelerates resistance. If you apply too much, you violate the law. The math is the barrier between success and failure.
In short, accurate calibration is the only way to demonstrate due diligence and maintain legal compliance.
Exactly. When things go wrong, the first document regulatory bodies ask for are your calibration records.
Okay, so a quick reminder. Most hand-operated equipment is mixed by concentration, not area. But powered equipment over 5 gallons must be calibrated by area.
And it must be done frequently as parts wear. The goal is to determine exactly how much area a full tank covers at a known speed and pressure.
Now for the heart of QAL Category B math, calibrating large area-based sprayers using the four factors.
The factors are tank capacity, travel speed, flow rate, and swath width.
Let's start with number one.
One, tank capacity. Never trust the manufacturer's rating. You must physically measure the tank capacity on a level surface. Use a flow meter or a large calibrated container, like a 5-gallon bucket, to fill the tank with measured water.
And you have to calibrate the gauge at the same time.
Yes. You must also calibrate the sight gauge or create a dipstick, marking specific volume increments for permanent reference.
Two, travel speed. This is a frequent area of error. You have to measure the travel speed under actual working conditions.
Or meaning on the type of surface you will be treating. You need accuracy, so a measurement distance of 200 to 300 feet is necessary.
Okay, so let's use the calculation to anchor this concept. We need to convert distance and time into miles per hour. Our source example shows an average of 1.77 decimal minutes to cover 187 feet.
Wait.
So we calculate feet per minute first, but then we have to convert that to mph. That conversion requires the constant 88. Why an 88? What does that number fundamentally represent?
That is the essential clarifying question. The constant 88 simply represents the number of feet traveled in exactly 1 minute if you are moving at 1 mile per hour.
It's the direct conversion factor.
It is. So if we take our feet per minute, which is 105.65, and divide it by 88, we get a travel speed of 1.23 mph. And the crucial takeaway is that the applicator must now maintain that speed perfectly consistently during the application.
Flow rate. Now we need the volume coming out. This is where we measure gallons per minute or GPM.
And this is critical. You must measure GPM for each nozzle separately, fill the tank halfway, maintain normal operating pressure, and collect the output from each nozzle over a measured time period.
To convert fluid ounces per second to GPM, we use another constant, 0.4688. Can you briefly explain where that comes from?
Of course. That constant is just a shortcut derived from two essential conversions. 60 seconds per minute divided by 128 fluid ounces per gallon. It just simplifies the math.
And this step doubles as the wear check. This is where we catch that 10% variance.
Absolutely. The hard stop is the 10% rule. If a single nozzle's output exceeds the manufacturer's rated output by more than 10%, that nozzle must be replaced immediately. If we see a 31.2% variation, for example, the risk of phytotoxicity is just too high.
In fact, swath width, the final factor for boom sprayers.
This is the total horizontal width covered. You have to adjust the boom height to ensure the required 30% overlap of adjacent nozzle patterns. And remember that 10-degree rotation of the fan nozzles.
Okay, so now we have the four factors. Let's walk through the operational logic of calculating the required tank dose for a per acre application using the figures we established.
The challenge is connecting the flow of liquid, the GPM, to the area being covered in acres.
Step one, acres treated per minute. We calculate how much ground we cover by multiplying swath width by travel speed and then dividing by the square feet in an acre, 43,560.
And using the source figures, that equals 0.0291 acres treated per minute.
Step two, gallons per acre, the GPA rate. This is the application rate. We divide our total system flow rate by the acres per minute. If the total flow is 1.525 GPM, dividing by 0.0291 acres per minute gives us 52.4 gallons per acre.
And that's the critical number you are applying.
Step three, acres per tank. This determines the total volume we're preparing. We divide our measured tank capacity, 55.5 gallons, by our GPA rate, 52.4. So our tank will treat 1.06 acres.
Which brings us to the final step.
Step four, the dose. We simply multiply the acres per tank, 1.06, by the labeled application rate, say 1.5 pounds per acre. This results in a required dose of 1.59 pounds of product for the entire tank.
And that math is the final check against the label.
And we use the exact same logic for smaller units calibrated to a per square foot rate. Convert speed and width to square feet per minute, then divide GPM by that number, and finally determine how many square feet the tank covers.
Exactly. For example, if your 3-gallon backpack covers 15,789 square feet, and the label requires 3 fluid ounces per 1,000 square feet, the calculation tells you the required dose is 47.37 fluid ounces. This level of certainty is the value of calibration.
Not all labels give an area rate. Sometimes we need to mix by concentration, particularly for specialized treatments.
This requires weight-weight basis calculations. Let's look at preparing a percentage solution, say a 1% solution of a specific liquid glyphosate in a 14.5-gallon tank. The key is knowing that a gallon of water weighs 8.34 pounds.
So we find the total weight of the solution, then calculate 1% of that weight to find the required weight of the active ingredient. That 14.5-gallon tank needs 1.21 pounds of AI.
Correct. The final step is translating that required AI weight into the volume of the formulated product. By dividing 1.21 pounds of AI by the formulation concentration, we find we need to add just 0.22 gallons of the concentrated product to the water.
And the ultimate in dilution is parts per million, or ppm.
Yeah, and you have to remember, 100 ppm is equivalent to a 0.01% solution. If we're preparing a 100 ppm concentration in a 25-gallon tank, we first calculate the total weight of the tank, which is 208.5 pounds. Then we convert 100 ppm to a fraction to find the required weight of AI.
Which is a tiny amount.
It is. The calculation shows we need only 0.021 pounds of active ingredient for the entire 25-gallon tank. When you translate that small weight into fluid ounces of the concentrated product, you find you need to add just 0.49 fluid ounces.
Wow.
It just illustrates the immense power and concentration of some chemicals and why precise, accurate dilution is absolutely not optional.
So we've covered liquids. Let's reiterate the challenge with granules.
Yeah.
Their flow rate is dynamic.
That's the critical knowledge. Granule flow rates change based on the product's specific size and shape, and critically, they are highly sensitive to weather and humidity. Applicators have to recalibrate far more frequently than they would for liquid systems.
Travel speed and swath width are calculated the same way. But how do we accurately measure the output rate for granules?
The tarpaulin method is the most accurate. You spread a plastic tarp of a known size, say 10 by 10 feet. You operate the spreader across it at the known speed, measure the swath covered, and then collect and weigh the granules.
And that gives you a pounds per square foot figure,
which you then compare against the label rate. If you are under-applying, you either open the port wider or slow your travel speed. If you are over-applying, you do the opposite.
And we've saved the specialized treatments for last. How do we calibrate for soil drenches and tree injections, where acres and square footage are irrelevant?
Rates here are based on the plant size, either the diameter at breast height, or DBH for trees, or the cumulative feet of plant height for shrubs.
Let's use the DBH example. The label calls for 1.2 teaspoons of product per inch of DBH.
So for a 15-inch DBH tree, we multiply 15 by 1.2, which requires 18 teaspoons, or 3 fluid ounces, of the concentrated product. That dose must then be diluted in a minimum water volume specified on the label.
When using a powered soil injector, we need time, not volume, per injection hole.
We measure the unit's output in quarts per minute. If the output is 5 quarts per minute and the label requires 1 quart per hole, we divide 1 by 5, which tells us it takes 0.20 minutes or 12 seconds of continuous injection time to deliver the required volume per hole.
And for handheld injectors, the calibration is done by determining the number of strikes.
Correct. You determine how many strikes deliver a measured volume, say 12 strikes deliver 3 fluid ounces. If the label requires 6 fluid ounces per hole, the math is simple. You need 24 strikes per hole to deliver the correct dose.
Finally, tree implants and capsules.
These systems are pre-measured. You determine the number of capsules needed based on the trunk DBH and the label's required spacing interval, say 1 capsule every 6 inches around the trunk. The calibration here is simply the measurement of the tree and ensuring correct spacing.
We've completed the deep dive. This has been an incredibly detailed look into the world of application equipment and calibration.
And what we've detailed today is the necessary technical foundation for safety, efficacy, and success in professional pesticide management. It's all geared toward your QAL Category B success.
We've covered everything from the low-tech safety requirements of an anti-siphon valve on a hose-end sprayer to the high-tech physics of electrostatic sprayers. We emphasize the critical maintenance role of identifying worn nozzles, that crucial 10% variation threshold.
And we focus intensely on the absolute necessity of precise calibration, walking through the logic of those four factors, tank, speed, flow rate, and swath width, to ensure that whether you are mixing by gallons per acre or parts per million, the dose is correct and legally compliant.
Mastering these technical details and this complex math is the definition of professional competence, and it's the foundation for practicing the safe, efficient, and legal pesticide application that drives the broader and better agriculture advocated by Within Range Coaching.
The math directly translates to environmental stewardship and profitability. It connects every part of the operation.
And that strategic mindset leads us to our final thought for you to mull over. We spend time detailing the undeniable safety benefits of tree injection and implantation, noting they completely eliminate drift. But we also highlighted the major trade-off. Those methods intentionally create physical wounds in the tree trunk.
Wounds that can compromise the tree's long-term health by serving as entry points for subsequent pathogens. The choice of application equipment is always a strategic risk assessment.
So when you're faced with a prized, decades-old heritage tree, how do you, the applicator, weigh the immediate low-drift benefit of injection against the long-term risk of structural damage or subsequent infection caused by the entry wounds themselves? Knowing the mechanics and the math is just the first step. The final decision is always a judgment call based on precise knowledge and strategic risk assessment.